Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Good afternoon and welcome. Welcome to an hour of Mind Power. This is Donna Sebo and we have a special program today. It's a program, well, it's about space travel. It's about a man who is a part of history, and it is about the changes in thinking, the changes in perspective that have evolved. It's his story. My guest today is Dr. Edgar Mitchell. And Dr. Mitchell, I want to welcome you to my program.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you, Donna.
Your book, The Way of the Explorer, this is a revised edition. It was told to me that you had put this book out a few years ago, and then recently it has come out as a paperback. This is your story about your journey through space, on Apollo 14, and the changes that it brought in your life. I'd like my audience to have a little bit more of information about you. You also, not only are you a graduate of MIT with a doctorate in aeronautics and astronautics, you are the founder of the Institute of Noetic Sciences and the co-founder of the Association of Space Explorers. As an astronaut, you were the backup lunar model pilot on Apollo 10 and 16, and flew as a lunar model pilot on Apollo 14. And you've been involved for over 35 years in studying human consciousness and psychic and paranormal phenomena because you believe, you know, that there's a common ground between science and spirit. And you speak all over the world. Dr. Mitchell, I felt that your book was so well done because there was this wonderful beginning where you talked about your family and talked about the way your life was when you came up in this world and how much it had a direct influence on your being able to become an astronaut. Give us a little bit of your family background. Tell us about your granddad, who was such a wonderful character, and the family members that had such a tremendous love of learning.
Well, thank you. Yes, I come from a long, fairly long line of Scots, Celts, and Swedes that ended up in West Texas in about 130 years ago after the Civil War, and in the ranching business. And I decided at some point along the line there that I wanted to go to an Eastern school, and I was encouraged to do that, and did. And at the time, when I graduated from college, the Korean War was on, and so was the draft. And I was advised that I was going to be quit drafted. And I didn't really want to do that, because I was already a pilot, and I wanted to fly. And I'd already had my pilot's license when I was 16, started flying when I was 13. And so I enlisted in the Navy, then got a commission and went to flight school. And the Korean War ended while I was on the way to the Pacific. And so to finish up my obligated service for pilot training and all of that, I was still aboard and coming home from the Pacific aboard an aircraft carrier in 1957, October the 4th to be precise, when Sputnik went up. And even though I really had no plans at that point to either to be a military pilot forever, that wasn't really my career, or to certainly be in the military, but that's where I was. And I suddenly realized that humans would be right behind robot spacecraft. And since my family did have a history of exploration and pioneering, that sounded like going out to find out what space was all about would be an interesting thing to do. And that was kind of when my career path diverged and went in that direction.
Some of the details in your life story I find so amazing. One of those details was about a neighbor of yours, Robert Goddard. And when I read that, I went, holy Moses, here you are, a man that is destined to go into outer space, and you worked very hard to be able to achieve it. But as a young boy, you had this man who is America's first rocket scientist out in this area of Texas, sort of isolated from everything. How well did you get to know Robert Goddard?
Well, I didn't really get to know Robert Goddard. He and his wife lived on a farm just down the road, and we children walked by his farm every day going to school until the school bus was provided. Then we rode by his farm. I eventually met Mrs. Goddard after my space flight, but Dr. Goddard, passed away in those years. And so I never got to meet him personally, but of course he was a legend there because, as the story goes, he was invited because of his propensity to set off rockets to leave Massachusetts and go out in the desert and go out in the country where people weren't so skittish about that. And so he ended up near Roswell. And of course there's a wonderful museum there dedicated to his efforts.
Another very significant man in the area of rocketry and atomic science is Wernher von Braun.
Mm-hmm.
This was a man that you got to know personally.
Yes, as a matter of fact, one of the highlights of my career was after my space flight, I was astronaut delegate to a NASA planning conference at St. Simon, Georgia, on an island resort area, and we were quartered in bungalows, and my housemates for that week of a planning conference were Wernher von Braun and Arthur C. Clarke, and so I got to know those two luminaries quite well, and very delighted to, one of the highlights of my career was to be able to spend a week with them in dialogue and discussing the future of spaceflight and so forth.
Both of these men, Von Braun was such a visionary. I mean, that was his passion. That's what he wanted more than anything else, was to be able to be a part of space travel.
That was his vision, was to use rocket science to begin to explore space. And he left NASA finally because it wasn't moving fast enough for him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In 1957, you ended up going to MIT. I was so fascinated with the fact that the people at MIT in 1957 were asking questions, is there life in outer space? There was this enthusiasm about exploration, and this, what a wonderful opportunity for you. You really knew that you wanted to do this, that you wanted to be involved in the space program. What was it like at MIT at that time? Because today that's almost a given in the minds of many people. But in 1957, that wasn't something that was talked about very much publicly, was it?
No, but the government at the beginning of the space program, once the Soviets had launched Sputnik and the space rivalry was underway at that point, had asked three prestigious universities, technical schools, MIT, Princeton, and Caltech, to set up programs in aeronautics and astronautics because we really knew nothing about what was happening in outer space. And so we had to find out, and these programs were set up in order to help give some qualification to those who wanted to be a part of this space exploration effort. And of course I did, and was one of the early people to be able to go through that program, along with many astronauts eventually went through one of the three programs at MIT, Caltech, or Princeton. And that was really wonderful that we got to do that, and at least have some academic understanding of what was going on.
here you are in the military. You make a statement about military environment, and that in being involved in the military, in being a pilot, you really had to develop your intuition. How did you start paying attention to that factor? What was it that alerted you to the fact that you had to develop this sense of yours so that it was going to be an ally for you instead of something that you looked at from a position of fear or ignorance?
I guess that's, aviation was still in its somewhat infancy in those days. Jet aircraft had just come along. But flying aboard aircraft carriers was a pretty tricky business. And I guess we learned fairly quickly that really good pilots didn't get into an airplane. They put them on. You became a part of the environment. And that's what test pilots ended up doing, is we always was able to say the difference between ordinary pilots and really good pilots was one of them got into an airplane and the other one put it on. And somehow I think I had the feel for that that made it work pretty well. And I was delighted to be able to do that. And all of the colleagues, of course, that I eventually ended up with in NASA were of that variety. They were the best of the best when it came to flying machines.
And I think it's that very same feel that those of you that went into space in the beginning and those that are going into space now have to have also.
No, of course, yes.
Because they're all pioneers.
It's still a challenging environment. There's not much room for error when they're in the space environment. That's true.
Now, you talk about your days as a test pilot. And all of this is significant because you had to go, before you went into Apollo 14, you had to go through so much strenuous testing. And test pilots, they had to go through particular testing in the 50s. Again, they were pioneers, just like you said. But you describe how you were flying a jet in desert area, 50 feet above the desert floor, and you were carrying a bomb. And you had to know how to do this so that you would be under the radar. That must have really been an adrenaline rush, or did that come after you landed?
Well, perhaps both, but when you're flying under those conditions, let me set that up a little bit. This was in the days of the late 50s, when there was still the threat of confrontation with the Soviet Union and all of those days post-World War II, where tensions were fairly high. And as military people and as warriors, as it were, now let me make it very clear, being a warrior wasn't really what I was about. Being an explorer was what I was about. And that's what we had to do. And I, in particular, was sent back from the Pacific to start to develop low-altitude bombing tactics, because a very high, sophisticated radar, high-reaching radar, and surface-to-air missiles were now being deployed in Korea and China from the Soviet Union. And if we were to be successful at what we did, we had to be able to counter that. So my job at that point in time was to develop low-altitude delivery tactics for nuclear weapons at one of our test facilities. And so I came back and was doing that. And it was from there that I was able to finally get on into, go on to school, get my doctorate, and then go into the NASA program, where I much preferred to be than having to be carrying weapons in the bomb bay of an aircraft. I kept wanting my profession to be obsolete when it came to warring and so forth. And that's been I'm pretty much a pacifist, and that's been my stance forever.
At MIT, when you were there getting your education, you got involved with quantum mechanics and the theory of relativity. And you make a statement in your book that at the time that you were involved with this, and I quote, "I didn't quite fully understand that at the bottom of all matter, there was no simple, coherent picture of physical reality." That's quite a sentence.
Well, that is the picture that the quantum mechanical formalism suggests to us these days. And even though we knew a lot more than we did in those days a long time ago, it's still at the bottom of nature is this quantum mechanical entanglement, and where probabilities are more likely than absolute knowledge of where things are. Now, things have changed a lot since those days, but nevertheless, the area of quantum mechanics is still a great mystery in the scientific world, and we know a lot more than we did then, but there's a lot of parts of it that are still quite mysterious. And it goes much closer than many would like to believe into the ancient areas of mysticism that the ancients talked about long before we came along with our scientific methods.
You wanted more than anything else to be involved in becoming an astronaut. You wanted very much to be in the Aerospace Research Pilot School at Edwards Air Force Base mm-hmm. in the Mojave Desert. There was a gentleman, Jack Van Ness, that enabled you to get that, and Chuck Yeager, who is just a legend of legends when it comes to flying, he was your teacher.
Yes, he was in charge of the school when I was out there, and I was privileged to go through the space portion of it while I was teaching in budding astronauts optimization theory and a few things in the test pilot school. And so, but it was because I was able to go to Edwards and was selected into the astronaut program from there that it finally got me into NASA that way. Yes, that's true.
Now, at the time you went through this training, you were 36 years of age, and I had to chuckle because at that time there was a myth, you said, about astronauts that those that were in this program were very little more than trained chimpanzees that had gone through the base a few years before. But by the time you started getting involved, there was a whole different feel. This wasn't make-believe. This was something that was really going to happen. It must have been so exciting for you to be a part of that. It must have really felt exhilarating.
Well, it was. And the early astronauts fought a very game battle with the engineering and science profession on how much control the astronaut would really have of the machine. But the early guys, Alan Shepard and the early fellows that preceded me, fought a very successful battle with NASA to say, hey, if you want us to go in them, we're going to have some control. We're not going to be like the chimpanzees you're sending up there. We want control of this machine. And so that's the way it eventually ended up. But there was a lot of dissension about whether that was going to happen or not at those days.
I can imagine, because it really was scary. Again, pioneers, every time they're going to be sending something up, and of course when they sent the monkeys up, they said, well, it's just a monkey. But it's a whole different view in their attitudes. My goodness, we're going to send people up. If they die, this is terrible. Maybe our project will be canceled. All of those fears came in, but the passion for being able to be the first on the moon. They couldn't be the first in space because the Russians had already accomplished that. But to be the first on the moon, that was a big one. That was a very big one. Now, you really found the people involved at NASA were so dedicated. You have nothing but the highest regard for those people that you interacted with at that particular time. And sadly, there was an accident, and prior to your group going up, Gus Grissom, Ed White, and Roger Chaffee, all of them died in
yes.
this accident. And that could have closed everything down, but it didn't. And it didn't discourage those of you that were going to go into the next journey.
Well, we all were aware that as being military people and in war, and being test pilots, you knew there's risks, and there always is risks. And there's always human error when you're pioneering something like this. But I think we all realized or believed that the risk was worth the reward, that the benefits of going in and doing this would be long-lasting, and that we really need to do it. And we all had that particular attitude. That's true.
Your statement, too, in your book, and for those of you that are just tuning in, my guest today is Dr. Edgar Mitchell. He flew on the Apollo 14 flight to the moon. His book is titled The Way of the Explorer, and it's about his life, what he went through, the people that were involved, and it really is something, if you have young people in your family, it is a must to have in the library, because we need to always remember that there are those people that put their lives on the line to make a difference. And Dr. Mitchell is one of those who did exactly that. You always were interested, as you say so many people are, and it's true, what is the origin of our existence? How
I'm
we
sorry,
came
I didn't quite
about
get
the
words.
Earth?
Just say that again, please.
What is the origin of the Earth? What is the origin of humanity?
Oh, yes, the cosmology, right.
Yeah, there's all of these questions. And that was one of the many arenas of curiosity that you and many of the people that have been involved in the space program are curious about, just
yes,
like people
absolutely.
That go under the sea to try to find out different things. What is it that constituted the beginning? And, again, I want to reiterate that there was that understanding that there could be a loss of life, that you have to deal with those facts. There's no guarantees. When you are sticking your neck out, when you have a risk, that's what you're doing. And you state in your book something I found extremely interesting. You said, space exploration alone holds the promise of eventual escape from a dying planet, provided we wisely manage our resources in the meantime and actually survive that long. Now, someone might say, that's a rather pessimistic statement. Is it?
Well, no. It's realistic in the sense that in the very distant future, our planet and our solar system has a finite life. But what I was trying to point out here is, number one, the problem of sustainability. That at this point in history, we're very much in danger of irreversibly damaging our planet through our overconsumption, our untrammeled population growth, our destruction of the environment, the climate changes that are taking place. And I make a very good case of that, the fact that since the early part of the 20th century, every measure of human activity has been on an exponential growth curve. And it doesn't take great genius to understand that exponential growth can't continue indefinitely in a finite space. And we live on a finite space on this little planet. And even at the beginning of the space program, the great thinker Buckminster Fuller was pointing out, we're the crew of spaceship Earth, but we're a crew of mutiny. And how can you run a spaceship with a mutinous crew? So there's a lot of little metaphors and sayings here that do help us get the idea across that we do have a finite, fragile little planet, and with our modern technology and with our weaponry that we've created, and even today with our enormous consumption patterns that are driving our civilization to the right into the ground, as it were, we have to rethink all of this. And so most of that, what I was trying to point out in The Way of the Explorer, is a lead up to we've got to take care of our planet much better than we have been doing in this century.
I agree. You bring out information about Frank Drake and Carl Sagan, who were able to obtain funds and government support to establish a radio astronomy project called the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, SETI.
Mm-hmm.
And you make the point in here that the unusual sightings, various events and conditions about UFOs, there are so many people that are now coming forward and talking about this because they want to tell the truth. And many of them are very mature individuals now. They figure nobody can really do anything to them and bother them. So they're giving out this information. And when someone has traveled to outer space, as you have, this is mind-changing. This is life changing, which is exactly what happened to you. When you were in space, did you see any unidentifiable flying objects?
No, I haven't. I have no first-hand experience at all. And but many of the astronauts in their aviation career prior to going into space, quite a few, Gordon Cooper, Deke Slayton, all of them passed on now, acknowledged the fact that they did have, they were vectored as aviators to chase UFOs. And some even said they had experiences on the ground itself, like at Edwards Air Force Base. So there's some lore in the astronaut program, but we, none of us, at least up to the Apollo program, had any direct experience or direct sightings in space itself that were not well identified.
In April 1970, there was a space flight that was done. And I love the stories that you bring out because you bring the environment of people being in these space modules right to the forefront and what they had to deal with. And Jack Swigert called in to Houston and said, we have a problem. Now, from the ground, here they are way, way out there in outer space. Apparently, they had an explosion, and it was finally determined by the people in Houston on the ground level what was going on. And you talk about how the training that you go through, such as in your case as a test pilot and as an astronaut, you learn how to think in a very unique way so that you can do problem solving. Can you go into that kind of thought process a little bit?
Well, it's just a matter of, really, it's a matter of learning to control your emotions so that you don't panic, learning to manage manage fear. And when you're not only 80 year, but when you're in the military and when you're in war, you better learn to manage your fear. But if you're going to be a professional test pilot, you need to do that also, because things do happen unexpectedly and get out of control. The whole point here is learning to manage yourself, to learning to be in command of your own emotions. And, you know, there's some nice points and there's some bad points about all of that, too. But that's a fundamental experience that people in the business have to be familiar with.
You talk about, prior to being on the Apollo 14 flight, coming into contact with a Dr. Edward Boyle, who did research at the Miami Heart Institute, and then a Dr. Edward Maxey. The three of you ended up with a conversation about consciousness.
Yes. These gentlemen were very advanced thinkers. They were very advanced thinkers. I happened to meet them on a scuba diving trip in the Bahamas, and we got to palling around together. And they were all interested in consciousness because, let me set it up for our readers a little bit, that since Cartesian days, the days of René Descartes back in the late 16th, early 17th century, and Newton, Descartes made the pronouncement accepted by the church that body, mind, physicality, spirituality belong to two different realms of reality. And that didn't really interact. And that served the noble purpose of getting the Inquisition off the backs of the intellectuals of that period, and they quit burning them at the stake, provided they stayed away from consciousness, mind stuff, spiritual stuff, which was the realm of the church. Well, that allowed science, as we have learned it, to arise, but it arose as a strictly materialist concept and has been that way for almost 400 years. And some of us, like Dr. J.B. Ryan and Ed Maxey and Ed Boyle and myself and many others, had experience with, I call it intuitive, others call it psychic experience. Intuitive is a better word because it's not paranormal at all. We now understand it's quantum-based information. But we were interested in that, and realized that if what Dr. Ryan and his colleagues had been doing in the laboratory at Duke University was validated and replicated in scientific method, that we in science were derelict and wrong in trying to discard or give no credence to their work. And we were talking about that, and as a result, we decided that shortly before the Apollo 14 flight, let's do a little experiment in space and see if we can duplicate the results.
Dr. Mitchell, may I stop you there? We need to take a break for a moment.
Okay.
And what I'd like to do is take the break, and then we're going to talk about this unique situation that went into outer space and nobody knew about it until much, much later. This is Donna Siebel. My guest today is Dr. Edgar Mitchell. His wonderful book is called The Way of the Explorer. It's a revised edition. It is absolutely awesome, a must read. We're going to come back. We're going to find out more about the experiment of the minds in just a moment. Don't go away.
Hello, this is Dr. Richard Petty, the author of Healing, Meaning and Purpose, and creator of the RichardGPettyMD.com website. I am thrilled and delighted to tell you that starting February 7th, 2008, at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, I'm going to be joining my friend Donna Siebel on her show on bbsradio.com. We're going to do this every month, and I can guarantee you that we're going to be sharing new information and new concepts that will astonish and inspire you.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Siebel to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna Siebel. My guest today is Dr. Edgar Mitchell. We're talking about his wonderful book, The Way of the Explorer. Dr. Mitchell was on the flight of Apollo 14. He's a part of history. And in this book, The Way of the Explorer, he is sharing some fascinating information on so many different levels. But right now, we're going to talk about that tremendously important adventure in the experience of the mind and using random numbers. Tell us about what happened and what you decided you were going to do on this flight.
Well, what we decided to do, Dr. Maxey and Dr. Boyle and myself, with a little egging from them, they really wanted to do this, was to see if we could replicate the sort of experiment that J.B. Ryan did in the laboratory by in space, at the distances of space. And the method was to use the five so-called Zener symbols, star, cross, wavy line, circle, and square, which were used in the laboratory. And so what we did was, those are five numbers, so we took the numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in groups of five and randomized them, and I wrote them down on a pad on my kneeboard so that I had 25 symbols randomly oriented among these five. And then presumably six times during the mission on the day's transit between the Earth and the Moon, I would assign those symbols to one of the numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and think about it for about 10 to 15 seconds, each one, and then go to the next one. And that was our experiment. Well, to make the long story short, we planned to do that six times. We really only did, I only was able to do it four times, but when we got back and finally had the results checked by Dr. Ryan and another scientist, Dr. Osis, we found that we got as good results as they did in the laboratory near at home. Chance could have produced our results one out of 3,000 experiments, which is pretty good results.
Then we realized
that I was able to do four sessions, and they had done six sessions. So when we corrected for when I had actually done it and not just randomness, when I actually had thought about these ideas, these symbols, and matched that up with when they, with the proper timing, the probability went up to 1 in 13,000 that chance could have produced our results. So we had demonstrated that we could get as good results at the distances of the moon as you could across a laboratory.
And that's what, about 200,000 miles?
How far out were you? 240,000 miles, right.
240,000 miles. That shows there's no such thing as time or space.
Yeah, and that's exactly what it turns out with, and that's because we now know, to jump ahead this many years here, that we're dealing with quantum phenomenon that are, it's a non-local quantum phenomenon, and that time and distance really doesn't make any difference here.
Well, there you were as extraterrestrials. I thought that was a wonderful way to describe the three of you. You were extraterrestrials in outer space, and who knows, maybe something or someone else saw us as UFOs, too, when we were out there. But this really created a shift in your life, especially when you were coming back into the Earth. You said you had an epiphany. What was that epiphany?
Okay, well, to set that up just a little bit, since my major task was as be responsible for the lunar spacecraft and the lunar surface activities. So when we were on the way home, my major jobs had been successfully completed, so I could be a little more relaxed and look at the heavens. And we were on our way home in the plane of the ecliptic, which is a plane that contains the Earth, the Moon, and the Sun, and rotating to keep thermal balance on the spacecraft so that every 2 minutes, as a result, a picture of the Earth, the Moon, the Sun, and a 360-degree panorama of the heavens presented itself through the cabin window. And this was awesome. I have to say to our listeners that what you can see in space is 10 times as bright as what you can see on the highest mountain on Earth because there's not any atmosphere, intervening atmosphere, to block the starlight. So you see it 10 times as bright and 10 times as numerous. And it really is overwhelming. And I realized from my astronomy training that the molecules of my body and the molecules in the body of the spacecraft and in my partner's bodies, in fact, all matter, is created in the furnace of star systems. And I realized that that was my matter that was created or prototyped in star systems. And that suddenly, instead of just being intellectual knowledge, it was very personal and visceral and accompanied by a joyous feeling of oneness with all nature, with the heavens. And I had never had such an experience. It was just overwhelmingly a joyous feeling. And I realized also that we humans forever had asked the question, who are we? How did we get here? Where are we going? What's this really all about? How do we really fit into the universe? And I realized that perhaps now we, as the first generation of spacefarers, and having this view of ourselves from outside of our planet, maybe we had to re-ask that question again from a new perspective, because this perspective was quite different than even seeing it from the highest mountain. And I realized that perhaps the story as told by our science at this point was incomplete and perhaps flawed, and the story as told by our cultural cosmologies, rooted in religion normally, was archaic and perhaps flawed, and we really needed to understand this better, and that the real difference between cosmologies of science and cultural traditions was this thing called consciousness, because science had never looked at it, and science was and has been our most successful methodology for discovering facts and for discovering new things about our nature. So that was the experience. And I came home. This happened for all the way home for 3 days when I had a few moments to look out the window. And I had started digging through the literature when I got home and found nothing in the science literature and nothing in the religious literature about this type of experience. So I asked some scholars from a nearby university, Rice University, anthropologists, paleontologists, people that had studied ancient ideas. to see if they could find anything in the ancient literature. And they came up with an explanation from the ancient Sanskrit, called it a samadhi, a salvakalpa samadhi experience, which you see things in, as they are in their separate individuality, but you experience them as a unity, as a oneness, and accompanied by ecstasy. And I said, gentlemen, that's exactly what this was all about. And I learned from that and further studies that these types of experiences were rooted in the lore of each and every culture, but the explanation of them is rooted in the culture and in the language of the culture. And the experience seems to be the same, but the explanations are culturally based, and we fight over whose explanation, whose God, the best God, but it's all really about the same thing. And it's a life-changing experience. There's no going back when you've had that type of experience.
I agree. It is life-changing, and you cannot close the mind down. It just won't let you do it.
That's
not
right.
At all. Mm-hmm. Once you have it, it's there. It's your experience. And then you just literally seem to be propelled into a whole new arena of experience, which is exactly what happened to you, because you left NASA in the fall of 1992. You decided that you really wanted to get into this study more. You founded the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and I love the story that you have in here about how when you were starting this up, you needed to get funding. It was a lesson for you just to trust the process, as you say. And you say there was an occasional miracle. And you had a young woman that drove up to your office at that time. She was in her early 20s. She was driving a battered Volkswagen microbus. That's how you described it in your book. And she ended up talking with you, and then she leaves you a check. She wanted to support you. Tell us the rest of that story.
Well, that's the way it happened. On a rainy Saturday morning, when I was concerned that we were going to be able to continue, our major source of funding, their parent company, had gone bankrupt a couple of months earlier, and we were scrambling to keep things going. And this young woman came up and wanted to talk and wanted to know what we were doing. So I took her and her young son, 6-year-old son, to lunch, and came back after lunch, and she asked for an autographed picture for her son. And, of course, I agreed to that. And while I was autographing the picture, she wrote out a check, handed it to me, and walked away saying thank you. And it was a $25,000 check that kept the Institute doors open and going for a few more months till we had a fundraiser, and Werner von Braun came out to help us with a fundraiser. So this was happening to us all the time, that when things were really desperate, miracles happened. Yep.
You talk about the synchronicity, about what you founded. You have a story in your book about a wonderful man, Norbu Chin. You talk about your mother and a particular healing she went through. We're going to be taking a break for just a moment. When we come back, we're going to talk about that and a little bit more. My guest today is Dr. Edgar Mitchell, Apollo 14 astronaut. His fabulous book, The Way of the Explorer. Stay tuned. We're going to have some more good things to share. Don't go away.
Do you want to lose weight? Do you deal with diabetes, high blood pressure, osteoporosis, or chronic pain? Do you want to know one of Dr. Perricone's 7 secrets to beauty, health, and longevity? Do you have 15 minutes a day to look and feel better? Then let me introduce you to TTAP, the workout that works. For the beginner or expert exerciser, learn from physical training specialist Teresa Tapp how, in just 15 minutes a day, you can burn fat and sugar, build strong bones and muscles, and lose inches fast with no equipment or jumping. Visit the TTAP website, ttap.com, or call 1-800-342-0717 to learn how. That's TTAPP.com. We'll help you lose inches, look good, and feel fabulous.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at Donna@DelphiInternational.com. That's Donna@DelphiInternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.DelphiInternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is Donna@DelphiInternational.com, and her website is www.DelphiInternational.com.
Hello, this is Donna Sebo. My guest today is Dr. Edgar Mitchell, Apollo 14 astronaut. We're discussing his book, The Way of the Explorer, his journey through the material and mystical world. Fascinating reading. Dr. Mitchell, you talk about a very, very special man, Norbu Chin, and you talk about a very insightful experience between this man and your mother. Will you share that story with my audience?
Yes, it's a very good story. It was shortly after my flight, the next year after my flight, and I was invited to speak at a conference that was featuring these types of events. And Norbu Chin, who had a Tibetan name and had studied in Tibet, was a healer. And I'd never had much experience with that at that time, but I had heard about it. And my mother came to this conference in Arkansas. She had driven over from her home in Oklahoma to be with me. And mother had glaucoma and thick Coke bottle glasses, legally blind without her glasses. And I decided, well, if Norbu's a healer and mother's got this type of health problem, if I can get them together, maybe I can learn something and help mom. So I got them together in my suite that evening. He was a good sport, and he was quite willing. And he did his mantra, his meditation, moving his hands over her head for a few minutes, and then suggested she go to her room, rest, have some grapefruit, get grape juice and broth, and let's see what tomorrow brings. And the next morning at 6 o'clock, my mother came into my room. We had a suite, and her Bible in one hand, she was a very devout Christian, her Bible in one hand, her glasses in the other, and saying, "Praise the Lord, son, I can read, I can see, and proceeded to read out of her Bible without glasses to show it to me. And I came up out of a dead sleep here, kind of groggy and not quite understanding what I was hearing. So she repeated herself and proceeded to read out of her Bible, and then dropped her glasses on the floor, ground them under her heel. "Praise the Lord, I can see." So what was I to do? Mama drove home that day with Sam's glasses, 200 miles, and I invited Norbu Chin to come live with me in Houston for a while so I could figure out what he was doing, which he eventually did. But the interesting part, is I touched base with my mother every day by phone in Oklahoma from Houston. And how's it going, Mom? Here I am. Oh, wonderful, son. I can see. Until a week later, Mother called me, and as soon as I knew, I could feel the ambience on the phone. As soon as I knew it was her, "Mom, what's the matter?" And her first words were, "Son, is Norbu a Christian?" And I said to myself, "Uh-oh, here it comes." And I wouldn't want to answer. And she said, "Son, is Norbu a Christian?" I said, "No, Mama, he's a Buddhist. He's a healer. He's a very good man." "Oh, I've been healed by Satan." And she had to go get her thick Coke bottle glasses back again, have some new ones made, because she couldn't see. Now, the interesting part, my mother was a very intelligent woman, and as time passed, she lived another 10 years after that. She was in her late 60s, and by the time she passed away 10 years later, her eyesight had slowly improved to the point where she just had, by the time she passed on, just light reading glasses, hardly any, something like 20/40. And what was going on in her mind was, well, if I turn this off, I guess I can get it back. She didn't really have her glaucoma back. She just refused to see.
Mm-hmm.
And it taught me about the role of belief system and how powerful our belief system is in affecting our physical reality.
Yes.
That was a very powerful lesson. And I did, by the way, bring Norbu to work with me, and we did some work at NASA. We had some of the NASA physicians at that point come and watch him heal people and test them and so forth. And, of course, in those days, it was still much too early for all of this to be very accepted.
Mm-hmm.
But we've had a lot of work. We've had a lot of experience with it in the meantime.
Addressing the belief, and I'm going to quote directly from your book, you say, it comes down to an individual's belief system which each of us constructs through the course of our lifetime. This physiological construct is really just stored information we gather through the years and weave into a story that has both conscious and subconscious components.
Exactly.
We use it to represent our reality.
Mm-hmm.
At any moment, the sum of information and the meaning we attach to it is derived from all of the experiences previously accumulated, sometimes seemingly insignificant experiences. Our beliefs cause us to see the world in a way that is unique to each one of us, as it is quite impossible to duplicate each step in a life's journey. This is the source of our story. And how very true that is. How very true that is. And we can change our story if we want to. But that takes being conscious with who we are. Now, I know we're coming close to completing our chat for today, Dr. Mitchell. I would like to be sure that my audience knows about your website, because
okay.
You said you had three that people could go to find out about latest research on the mind and the Institute of Noetic Science. Who all is involved with this research?
Well, I've got, besides the folks at Noetics and the organization up at Petaluma, we have a 200-acre campus up there, and the people working there. But I also have a team of scientists that are in Europe and the United States that are more independent, and they're with another organization doing hard science, really in the physics and chemistry and biology of these problems. And the websites, in particular, my personal website is called www.edmitchellapollo14.com, edmitchellapollo14.com. And then the one at Noetics, it's noetic.org, N-O-E-T-I-C.org. And then the hard science organization called Quantrek, Quantrek.org. And we're all working toward understanding ourselves better and helping to move this, our civilization towards a more sustainable set of circumstances.
Let me give out those websites again. There are three of them. Ed Mitchell Apollo 14, and those are the numerals 14.
Right.
Ed Mitchell Apollo 14. Number two is noetic.org, N-O-E-T-I-C.org. The third one that deals with the hard science of the research that's being done by dedicated people from different parts of the world, it's quantrek.org. Quantrek.org. Dr. Mitchell, it's been an absolute delight having you as a guest today. I would hope that your message would be out there for so many young people, because we need to have the engineers, the scientists, those that want to go, as it says on Star Trek, where nobody else has gone before. Because that's really what it is. It's all about exploring new territory. It's the pioneering experience is still there, available for those that really dare to do it.
Thank you for inviting me on, Donna. It's been great. It's been
well, it has been
experience.
A delight having you as a guest. This Thanks. Is Donna Sebo. Regrettably, we're out of time. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. When you recognize that your mind is a resource that you can utilize to make your life richer and better, you have taken a giant step forward that's phenomenal. Read Dr. Mitchell's book, The Way of the Explorer. He is a pioneer, but he's a man that is still walking the walk, not just talking the talk, because he believes in what he does, and he knows there's something bigger and better and greater that we can reach out to make our life a richer experience. This is Donna Sebo. We'll be back same time, same place tomorrow. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.